From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
On the 26th of February back in 2012, Trayvon Martin, who was visiting his dad in Sanford, Florida, decided to head out to a nearby 7-Eleven. He picked up a packet of Skittles and an iced tea, and on the way back, he was spotted by a neighbourhood watch captain, George Zimmerman, who called 911 to report a, quote, real suspicious guy. What happened next was tragic, almost unbelievable. The unarmed black teenager, he was only 17 years old at the time, was confronted, shot and killed by George Zimmerman. Trayvon Martin's death and later the fact that a Florida jury found Zimmerman not guilty of Martin's death sparked national outrage and reignited the debate on racial profiling and civil rights.
Just a couple of years later, in 2014, Michael Brown, an unarmed black man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, by a white police officer. Watching the reaction to that unfold, even from a distance, it became very clear that despite the election, twice, of an African-American president, racial tensions in the US were far from being overcome.
United we be, ceasing all this fire, this violence, discrimination, we will be free.
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!
And there's something about all this, a white man shooting and killing a black man, then getting away with it. Police brutality, the protests, that's reminiscent of the civil rights movement back in the 50s and 60s. And when I spoke to an expert about this, he made it very clear that while some things have changed, race relations in the US remain deeply problematic.
The term I tend to use is the long shadow of the plantation.
This is Professor Albert J. Roboteau from Princeton University. He's an expert in the African-American religious experience and the history of slavery and civil rights in the U.S.
So that, as historian Edmund Morgan says, the story of American history has been a kind of counterpoise between American slavery and American freedom. Indeed, freedoms have been spread to a larger group of people over time. But that spread has been at the cost of the ongoing oppression of black people in ways that have become very apparent in, thanks to video cams and cell phones that betray the brutality of the police state that we sometimes live in as black people.
The recent presidential election was even more revealing.
White supremacy is still alive and well in our society, and we're seeing its recrudescence in some very serious ways currently in the political scene. The notion that this is a white country is one that is demographically doomed, but it won't pass without some strong reactions on the part of white people who want to bring back America the Great.
Race relations in America are as complex as ever. So we asked Professor Roboteau to guide us through some of the key moments of the civil rights movement and how it continues to impact and influence American society and culture today.
Yeah, it was a real honour to do this interview. He was actually someone I interviewed on our US trip for CPX's documentary that's coming out this year. Not only because he's an expert in all this, but he's actually lived the civil rights movement. It's personal for him.
My father was killed by a white man in Mississippi 3 months before I was born. And the white man who killed him was never tried. He claimed self-defense and he wasn't indicted even. When I was growing up, I knew that my father was dead. My mother and stepfather raised me. But they didn't talk about the circumstance of my father's death. I didn't indeed find out about it until I went back to Mississippi when I was 50 years old to investigate. And when I was 17 and getting ready to go off to college, they sat me down and for the first time explained to me what had happened. And they said, the reason we didn't tell you before this was we didn't want you to grow up hating white people. Now, I had two responses to that. One was I was glad that they told me. Second response was, what kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
It was because of this, because his father was killed, that his mother moved the family from the South to the Midwest. And it took him quite a while before he returned to Mississippi to find out what really happened.
But when I went back when I was 50, I talked to some of my relatives about it. Most of them didn't want to talk about it, but a few did. And I went to the police department in Bay St. Louis, the town I was born in, and found the record of the murder of my father. And one of the policemen said that he had heard that the son of the man who had murdered my father lived in a close by town. So I found his name in the phone book and I called him up and I said, out of the blue, I'm the son of Albert Raboteau, whom your father killed, and I'd like to know what your family's version of that story is. And he said, oh, yes. He paused a minute and he said, yes, I was 9 years old when that happened, so I remember your father. And I remember him as a big, burly man, and he and my father fought, and my father pulled a gun in self-defense and shot him. Well, I have a picture of my father standing between my two sisters. One was 11, one was 13. He's barely taller than my 11-year-old sister. It was his build was like mine. He was very slender, and so he was not a burly man. And so I didn't challenge him about that, but I did say, what happened to your father? And I said, he came down with terminal cancer and he shot and killed himself. And I was very tempted to say, did he use the same gun as he did when he got shot my father? But I thought that would have been cruel, so I didn't.
Roberto didn't get angry. He didn't hate the man who killed his father. And he told me that because he didn't know about how his father died, his mother actually succeeded in raising him as a man who didn't hate white people. But he did carry a particularly painful scar from this. He didn't have a sense of who his father was.
After that conversation, I visited my father's grave, and I had been there many times over the years. But for the first time, I began to cry. And it was as if, in my mind's eye, I saw him. I saw him getting shot. And I saw him falling, and it was as if he was falling into my arms and into my life. And it was as if a father and son had finally met. Mm. And then I bent down and I picked some dirt up from his grave and I rubbed it on my forehead, which I later learned was a very African gesture. And then I walked away.
One of the really devastating things about this story, though, is that it's a story that's repeated throughout Black American history. The senseless, brutal death of a father or mother, brother or sister, daughter or son. And it's all too familiar for so many African American families and communities.
But what's also familiar is this sort of response, this idea that violence can't be fought with more violence. Hatred can't be fought with more hatred.
One night when the Montgomery bus boycott had gotten started, he received a telephone call, and it was a threat from someone who said that he was going to be killed, his family was going to be killed, his house was going to be bombed. And he just, you know, it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back.
Roberto's talking about Martin Luther King here and the roots of his philosophy of nonviolence. King was influenced by people like Gandhi and Thoreau, but by far the biggest influence for him was Jesus. King took his cues from his father, his grandfather and great-grandfather. They were preachers and activists. And it was important for him that black social justice would emerge from the black church. A deeply personal spiritual epiphany was a key marker as well.
He just sat down at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee and said a prayer, which basically was, Lord, I'm down here trying to do good, but I'm losing my courage, and I can't let others see me losing my courage, because then they will lose their will to fight this fight. And he said he heard a voice speaking to him saying, Martin Luther King, stand up for what's right, stand up for justice, and I will never abandon you, I will never leave you, I'll never leave you alone, I'll never leave you alone. And for King, that kitchen table experience became for him the rock solid basis for his activism, even though he knew as his life went on and on that he was not going to die in bed.
Nonviolence wasn't just a tactic for King, it was his way of life.
It was a way of life that reflected the Creator in whose image and likeness all of us were made. And so for him, nonviolence respected the divine image within each person. Now, not everyone was nonviolent in the civil rights movement. And people who were nonviolent often didn't believe in nonviolence as a way of life, but viewed it more as a political tactic. So Fannie Lou Hamer, for example, had 7 guns in her house, just in case. Or as one tenant farmer put it, this nonviolence can get you killed. So for many people, it was seen as a political tactic, not as a way of life. But for King and many of his followers, it was seen as a way of life that is in consonance with the image of God within all of God's creatures. There is a deep root, I think, in the African-American community that has always appreciated that hate restored or inspired as a way of attacking hate is a no-win situation. And that hate and even resentment, as King and others taught, leads to the corrosion of the individual person's own humanity. It just doesn't attack the other, but it attacks and has an effect upon the individual.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Albert Robitaux, Professor of Religion at Princeton University, is guiding us through some of the key moments in the civil rights movement. And we're pausing at some deeply personal moments on the way. Like this time when he was a kid taking piano lessons from a white woman in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where he grew up. It was around the time of the desegregation of Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. The governor had mobilized the National Guard to try and stop 9 African-American students from integrating into the high school.
One day, we had finished the lesson, and she turned to me and she said, I want to apologize to you. You know, I'm 7 or 8 years old. I said, for what? You know, she said, for what my people are doing in Little Rock, Arkansas. That's the effect of people actually seeing and empathizing with the sufferings of others.
Eventually, President Eisenhower managed to bring an end to the crisis by removing the National Guard from the governor's control, and he ordered 1,000 American troops to oversee the integration. Those 9 African-American students entered the school in September 1957, and 8 completed the school year, but they also faced constant discrimination from other students.
And this is a recurring theme in the civil rights movement. There are wins, but they come with incredible struggle, pain and tremendous sacrifice. One of the most powerful examples of this was Bloody Sunday. In 1965, during a round of nonviolent protests in Selma, Alabama, a state trooper shot Jimmie Lee Jackson, a 26-year-old black church deacon. He died 8 days later. The protesters took to the streets once again and made their way through Selma across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where they faced a blockade of state troopers and police. When the crowd tried to press on, they were attacked.
So when the beating at the Edmund Pettus Bridge was shown on television, it interrupted on one of the major networks, a showing of the movie Judgment at Nuremberg. You know, how fitting. Mm-hmm. And the beating was shown and moved to Birmingham. When people see images, pictures or live images of the water cannons turned on children, or the police dogs, you know, biting unarmed protesters. What happens is people says, is this America? How can this happen? You know, and then, you know, what can be done about it? So these iconic moments were important in terms of creating an awareness of the ongoing evil of racism and showing how it has, it calls into question our national identity, the notion of our exceptionalism. Yeah, America's exceptional, all right. It beats its black people. It sends police dogs to attack unarmed demonstrators and water cannons to knock over children. So to see what's going on stirs up the conscience and creates the possibility of a movement for change.
We actually did some filming in Alabama on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and you know, 50 years on from Bloody Sunday, it was pretty eerie. And with the current state of race relations, the Black Lives Matter movement, and one of the most divisive presidential elections happening at the time that we were filming there, I just got a real sense of how, when it comes to civil rights, there's a lot that's happened, but obviously there's a long way to go.
I took a group of students, both undergraduate and graduate students, and some alumni on a civil rights tour. And one of the places that we went was Selma. And Joanne Bland, a woman who was beaten as a child on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, runs a civil rights museum right at the foot of the bridge. And on the wall, she showed us a card that had been sent by one of the white troopers who had beat her and others on the bridge, apologizing, saying that he repented for what he had done, regretted it, and wanted to express his sorrow. And then one of the older alumni who was along with us in his 70s, had arthritis, he had been down to march in Selma, and he told her that he had been one of the marchers. And she gave him a big hug and said how important it was to them that white people came so that they knew they were not alone, that knew that the nation knew about them. And they both started crying and they hugged each other, and the rest of us started crying as well. So after that, the group was going to walk across the bridge. And I got out. I thought, I don't need to walk across the bridge. I've already seen the bridge in terms of these two people hugging each other, one who was beaten and one who came to bear witness to the injustice of that beating. So for me, I had already crossed the bridge.
From the Center for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation with Albert J. Robertot. He actually gave me a copy of his latest book. It's called American Prophets, Seven Religious Radicals and Their Struggle for Social and Political Justice. It's a fascinating read. And if you're interested in this period in civil rights and race relations in the US, I highly recommend it.
If you want to learn more about the documentary that we were doing this interview for, go to fortheloveofgodproject.com. And if you want to hear more conversations like this, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. Just recently, we had Alistair McGrath talking about why he turned from atheism to Christian faith and how his background in science, surprisingly perhaps, played a big role in that shift.
Next week, we explore Melbourne's nightlife with a group of street pastors. I hope you join us then.